Excerpt from Amazing Grace by Jonathan Kozol. Walking into St. Anne's Church on a hot summer afternoon, one is immediately in the presence of small children. They seem to be everywhere. In the garden, in the hallways, in the kitchen, in the chapel, on the stairs. The first time I see the pastor, Martha Overall, she is carrying a newborn baby in her arms and is surrounded by three lively and excited little girls. In one of the most diseased and dangerous communities in any city of the Western world, the beautiful old stone church on St. Anne's Avenue is a gentle sanctuary from the terrors of the streets outside. A 7-year-old boy named Cliffy, whose mother has come to the church to talk with Reverend Overall, agrees to take me for a walk around the neighborhood. His mother cautions me. He does tell fibs. Then gives him a hug and tells him, "Be as interesting as you always are." There are children in the poorest, most abandoned places who, despite the miseries and poisons that the world has pumped into their lives, seem when you first meet them to be cheerful anyway. Cliffy, as we set out on a St. Anne's Avenue, seems about as buoyant and as lively and as charmingly mysterious as 7-year-olds anywhere. He also seems to feel no shyness and no hesitation about filling the role of guide that he has been assigned. Reaching up to take my hand the moment that we leave the church, he starts a running commentary almost instantly, interrupting now and then to say hello to men and women on the street, dozens of whom are standing just outside the gateway to St. Anne's, waiting for a food pantry to open. At a tiny park in a vacant lot less than a block away, he points to a number of stuffed animals that are attached to the branches of a tree. "Bears," he says. "Why are there bears in the tree?" I ask. He doesn't answer me, but smiles at the bears affectionately. "I saw a boy shot in the head right over there," he says a moment later, in a voice that does not sound particularly sad, then looks up at me and asks politely, "Would you like a chocolate chip cookie?" "No, thank you," I say. He has a package of cookies and removes one. He breaks it in half, returns half to the package, and munches on the other half as we are walking. Leading me across the avenue, he hesitates in front of a bodega, looks in both directions up and down the street, then seems to come to a conclusion. "Okay, I think we need to go up here." We head north for a block or two, then turn right and walk a long block to a rutted street called Cypress Avenue. After crossing Cypress, he hesitates again. "Do you want to go down there?" he asks. I say, "Okay," not knowing what he means. "They're burning bodies there," he says. "What kind of bodies?" "The bodies of people," he says in a spooky voice, as if he enjoys the opportunity to terrify a grown-up. "Is that the truth?" He acts as if he didn't hear my question and begins to hum. The place that Cliffy is referring to turns out to be a waste incinerator that was put in operation recently over the objections of the parents in the neighborhood. The incinerator, I am later reassured by Reverend Overall, does not burn entire bodies. What it burns are so-called red bag products, such as amputated limbs, bedding, bandages, and syringes that are transported here from 14 New York City hospitals. The waste products of some of these hospitals, she says, were initially going to be burned at an incinerator scheduled to be built along the east side of Manhattan, but the siting of a burner there had been successfully resisted by the parents of the area because of fear of cancer risks to children. Munching another cookie as we walk, Cliffy asks me, "Do you want to go on Jackson Avenue?" Although I don't know one street from another, I agree. "Come on," he says, "I'll take you there. We have to go around this block." He pauses then, however. "Wait a minute." And he pulls an asthma inhaler from his pocket, holds it to his mouth, presses it twice, and then puts it away. Silent for a while as we walk to Jackson Avenue, he stops when he sees a dog he knows. "That's Princess," he explains. To the dog, he says, "Hi, Princess." Then to me, "You see? We're almost there." He stops again to ask if he can hold my tape recorder. When I hand it to him, he studies the red light to be sure that it is working, and then whispers, "We are going to have a conversation." As confident and grown up as he sounds, he has the round face of a baby and is scarcely more than 3.5 feet tall. When he has bad dreams, he tells me, I go in my mommy's bed and crawl under the covers. At other times, when he's upset, he says, I sleep with a picture of my mother and I dream of her. Unlike many children I have met in recent years, he has an absolutely literal religious faith. When I ask him how he pictures God, he says, he has long hair and he can walk on the deep water. To make sure I understand that this is an unusual ability, he adds, nobody else can. He seems to take the lessons of religion literally also. Speaking of a time his mother sent him to the store to get a pizza, 3 slices, one for my mom, one for my dad, and one for me, he says he saw a homeless man who told him he was hungry, but he was too cold to move his mouth. He couldn't talk. How did he know that he was hungry if he couldn't talk? He pointed to my pizza. What did you do? I gave him some. Were your parents mad at you? He looks surprised by this. Why would they be mad? He asks. God told us, share. When I ask him who his heroes are, he first says, Michael Jackson, and then, Oprah! Like that, with an exclamation on the word. I try to get him to speak about important persons, as the schools tend to define them. Have you read about George Washington? I don't even know the man, he says. We follow Jackson Avenue past several boarded buildings and a flat fix shop, stop briefly in front of a fenced-in lot where the police of New York City bring impounded cars, and then turn left in the direction of a highway with an elevated road above it, where a sign says Bruckner Boulevard. Crossing beneath the elevated road, we soon arrive at Locust Avenue. The Medical Waste Incinerator, a new-looking building, is gunmetal blue on top and cinder block below. From one of its metal sliding doors, which is half open, a sourly unpleasant odor drifts into the street. Standing in front of the building, Cliffy grumbles slightly, but does not seem terribly concerned. You sure that you don't want a cookie? Again, I say, no, thank you. I think I'll have another one, he says, and takes another for himself. After we cross Bruckner Boulevard again, he stops to consider the direction we should go. You want to go the hard way or the easy way back to the church? Let's go the easy way, I say. Well, actually, they're both the same, he says. But if we go up this way, I can show you where my store is. When we get to the grocery that he calls his store, he walks right in and says hello to the man behind the counter, who's friendly to him, then walks out again and sees a young man standing in a doorway who, he tells me, is his cousin, and then another man who is, he says, my other cousin, and to whom, he says, hi, Woody. He holds up the tape recorder, which he is still carrying, and asks his cousin, how old are you? The man replies, I'm 32. Okay, says Cliffy, fiddling with the tape recorder. I think we can give this thing a rest. He turns it off and hands it back to me. Next to another vacant lot where someone has dumped a heap of auto tires and some rusted auto parts, he points to a hypodermic needle in the tangled grass, then, for no reason that I can discern, starts puffing up his cheeks and blowing out the air. The day is coming when the world will be destroyed, he finally announces. Everyone is going to be burned to crispy cookies. A car stops at that moment so that we can cross a busy street. See that? He says. They let us cross. As we cross, he waves at the driver, who doesn't seem to know him, but waves anyway. After we cross, he asks me, can I have the tape recorder back? I hear him whispering into the microphone, we're out of cookies. I ate a whole bag of cookies. They're all gone. Back again on St. Anne's Avenue, he sees a man he knows close to the church and says hello to him. The man nods. How you doing, little man? He holds up the tape recorder to the man. Say how old you are. The man says, 65. Okay, says Cliffy. That's enough. So long. Inside the church, his mother looks at me with some amusement on her face. Did this child wear you out? No, I say. I enjoyed the walk. I mention, however, that he took me to the waste incinerator and repeat his comment about burning bodies, to which she responds by giving him a half-sarcastic look, hesitating, and then saying, hey, you never know. Maybe this child knows something we haven't heard. After giving him another pleasantly suspicious look, She leans back in a chair and folds her arms like someone who is getting ready to say something she's planned to tell me all along. The point is that they put a lot of things into our neighborhood that no one wants, she says. The waste incinerator is just one more lovely way of showing their affection. I ask, does it insult you? It used to, she replies. The truth is, you get used to the offense. There's trashy things all over. There's a garbage dump 3 blocks away. Then there's all the trucks that come through stinking up the air, heading for the Hunts Point Market. Drivers get their drugs there. Then we get illegal dumpers, people who don't live here come and dump things they don't want. Broken televisions, boxes of bottles, old refrigerators, beat-up cars, old pieces of metal, other lovely things. They do it in the wee hours of the morning. Actually, she says upon reflection, I've got quite a few nice things that way. Not long ago, somebody dumped a pile of chairs and tables in the street, brand new. I was offended, but I was also blessed. I took 2 chairs. A small and wiry woman wearing blue jeans and a baseball cap, a former cocaine addict who now helps addicted women and their children, she tells me that more than 3,000 homeless families have been relocated by the city in this neighborhood during the past few years, and she asks a question I will hear from many other people here during the months ahead. Why do you want to put so many people with small children in a place with so much sickness? This is the last place in New York that they should put poor children. Clumping so many people, all with the same symptoms and same problems, in one crowded place with nothing they can grow on. Our children start to mourn themselves before their time. Cliffy, who is listening to this while leaning on his elbow like a pensive grown-up, offers his tentative approval to his mother's words. Yes, he says. I think that's probably true. He says it with so much thought and grown-up reservation that his mother can't help smiling, even though it's not a funny statement. She looks at him hard, grabs him suddenly around the neck, and kisses him. In the evening, I go back to look more closely at the corner lot that I had passed with Cliffy, where he pointed out the stuffed bears in the branches of a tree. In the semi-darkness, I can make out several figures, some of them standing, some squatting on their knees, then many more, perhaps 2 dozen people, some of whom are talking to each other, some apparently transacting business, others who are sleeping. It is, I later learn, one of many drug parks in the South Bronx that police sometimes try to shut down, but, for the most part, leave in place for those who have no other place to shoot their drugs or drink their wine. The stuffed animals are tied by strings to the branches of the tree, a curious sight, which I later share with a woman cleaning up the kitchen in the basement of the church, who simply nods at this and says, "They're children's bears," but does not attempt a further explanation. The pastor tells me that the place is known as Children's Park. Volunteers arrive here twice a week to give out clean needles to addicted men and women, some of whom bring their children with them. The children play near the bears or on a jungle gym while their mothers wait for needles. At 9 p.m., Reverend Overall offers to drive me downtown to Manhattan. 3 hungry-looking dogs run past us when she pushes back the gates to the garden of the church to get to her car. The dogs disappear into a section of the churchyard where, she says, one of our nation's founding fathers, Governor Morris, who wrote the preamble to the U.S. Constitution, has his resting place. His wife, Ann Morris, is buried here beside him.